Hello, and welcome to Discussions with DPIC. I'm Anne Holsinger, Managing Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Our guest today is Dr. Sally Satel, a psychiatrist and senior fellow with the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Satel recently wrote an op-ed for the National Review outlining her reasons for supporting a ban on the death penalty for people with severe mental illness. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we'll be discussing the role of mental illness in death penalty cases. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Satel.
Thank you for having me.
So to start off, your career has focused primarily on mental health policy, but not on the legal system specifically. So what prompted you to write about mental illness and the death penalty?
I've actually written about that a bit before, but you're right, I didn't focus on it. And also this year, I'm doing a forensic psychiatry fellowship at St. Elizabeth's Hospitals. So I guess I'm especially sensitized to it. But I do remember in October reading an article in the New York Times about a case, a gentleman named Andrew Lee Thomas, who was denied, I guess, effectively a retrial based on a violation of the Eighth Amendment, competent representation. And so that got me very interested in him, you know, read more about his story, which is incredibly dramatic. And he's just a classic instance of a problem that I had thought about before, and actually once worked a little bit with Tennessee on this, which is the idea that, or frankly, the question I had, which is why are people with severe mental illnesses, and by that I mean psychotic illnesses, you know, like schizophrenia, bipolar illness, delusional disorders, how is it they could be eligible for the death penalty in the first place? And this gentleman, Andrew Lee Thomas, actually his execution date was scheduled for April 5th. It was ultimately stayed, not commuted, but stayed for a while. We can get back to him. But his case to me was just a stunning example of someone who committed a crime while psychotic. He had, you know, his rationale is something no one could consider sane. I mean, in other words, his motivation to kill was based on delusional thinking and command hallucinations. So how someone could be considered culpable for a crime they commit in that kind of mental state always seemed just so unjust to me. So then I kept writing about him around the time of April 5th and wondered what was going to happen. So that's how I got interested in him.
Yeah. So to talk a little bit more about that particular case, Andre Thomas is a Texas death row prisoner who killed his estranged wife, their 4-year-old son, and his wife's 1-year-old daughter while experiencing hallucinations that led him to believe that what he was doing was God's will. Mr. Thomas later gouged out his eyes and ate one of them. What do you think is the appropriate consequence for a defendant like Andre Thomas, whose crime was the result of his severe mental illness?
Well, he did enter a not guilty by reason of insanity plea, but there are several layers of problem with this case. Some have to do with his specific case and the quality of his representation. And then there's the larger, you know, the larger issue of whether, again, anyone who was severely mentally ill during the commission of their crime should be eligible for the death penalty, which is different than being eligible for some punishment, but eligible for the death penalty. And if I could just fill out a little bit of the details about him, they're almost even more bizarre, if you can imagine, than you just summarized. Yes, in March 2004, as you say, he was 20 years old at the time. This is in a town called Grayson, Texas, which I gather is a very conservative town north of Dallas. Yeah, he woke up to the voice of God telling him to commit those murders, and he cut out their hearts. He intended to cut out his wife's heart, but he missed and took out some lung by mistake. And his purpose was to, quote, free them from evil. Then he stabbed himself, thinking he intending to die, but he didn't. And so that same day, all this is happening in the same day, he turned himself in and he asked the police, you know, will I be forgiven? I thought I was doing the will of God. He didn't even believe his family was dead. So right there, you have just overwhelming evidence that this is someone who is delusional. Plus, he had been diagnosed with schizophrenia years before. So he was in jail. He actually, the psychiatric technical word for this is enucleation, which means blinding oneself by removing an eyeball. He did that twice. He did it several days after the murders while he was in jail waiting for some kind of disposition when he read a passage in the Bible. And then, of course, the trial was postponed for a year until he could be made competent to stand trial. And there was even a question about whether he was competent to stand trial. And then other problems with that trial. For example, there were people who were chosen to be on the jury, but they had expressed during the voir dire, they had expressed significant reservations about interracial marriage. And Andre was Black, and his wife, his estranged wife, was a beautiful white woman. So right there was this racial tension. But the trial went on, and there were even problems with that. His previous mental history had not been presented. So again, there are lots of questions that his own lawyer and others have had about whether his representation was even competent, and whether he was competent even to be at trial at that time. But fast forward, yes, he did then, he lost his insanity plea, in large part, I should add, because there was a question of whether he had taken cold medicine, and he did abuse quercetin, which is over-the-counter cold medicine, which he would sometimes take in high doses. It wasn't clear that his blood level was significant at the time to have influenced his mental state, but that was brought up by the prosecution and had a big role in why he did not get not guilty by reason of insanity. So he was on death row, and then 3 years later, right, took out his other eye, which is incredible, even while he was on medication. So he's still there, as I mentioned, was scheduled to be executed on April 5th, but his lawyers managed to convince Governor Abbott and the Bureau of Prison to wait for him 120 days to make sure that he was, in fact, competent to be executed, which is another kind of competence, because his lawyer contends that he's still quite psychotic. And to be considered competent for execution, you have to meet two criteria. One is that you know you're going to be executed. And the second is that you have an appreciation of why you're going to be executed. And she believes that he will probably fail the second prong. Whether the state will take that into consideration and commute him is not known. So kind of that's where we are right now. He's still on death row and remains delusional and blind. And what should happen to someone like that? Well, in his case, he should have, I believe, in retrospect, that he should have qualified for the not guilty by reason of insanity, in which case he would not be free. He would go to a forensic facility for quite a while and probably up to 20 years. I mean, these are long sentences. Excuse me, they're not sentences because he'd been found not guilty, but these are long stays in forensic mental institutions. And that's really where he should be.
So to zoom out a little bit from this one particular case that does illustrate a lot of these important issues, your op-ed in the National Review, you explained that no civilized or lawful purpose is served by executing the severely mentally ill. Could you expand on that a little bit and explain what you mean by that?
Sure. I don't think it's civilized, and I'm not alone in this at all, to blame someone and then punish him or her because they did not know what they were doing. He knew what he was doing in terms of murdering someone. He knew he was killing them. That there's no question about that. He didn't think he was killing dolls or animals or aliens. I mean, he knew he was killing human beings and their relationship to him, but he did not have a rational knowledge of that wrongdoing. He really didn't appreciate the significance and consequences of it because he thought he was actually, in a way, saving them from evil. So that's clearly a delusional premise. And in terms of the law, I mean, it doesn't serve the purposes of retribution, which, you know, I think, I mean, I know this is a matter of debate among legal scholars, but I think there's some merit to the concept of retribution, but it's invalid in a case like his because he was not rational. His capacity for moral logic was distorted by the fact that he was commanded by God and that he believed again that he was, you know, they were evil and embodied evil, and he was freeing them from that. So if you're not rational, then you're not really blameworthy or culpable, or as blameworthy or as culpable as you might otherwise be. And then, you know, the next step is that there should be diminished or no punishment. His case, as would be the case with anyone who committed a murder based on delusional, deranged thinking, would not really meet the requirements of the ethic of retribution.
You also argue that the same reasoning in Atkins versus Virginia, which exempts those with intellectual disability from a death sentence, should be extended to those with severe mental illness. In particular, the Supreme Court said that people with intellectual disability cannot be subject to the death penalty because of their, quote, diminished capacities to understand and process information, to communicate, to abstract from mistakes and learn from experience, to engage in logical reasoning, to control impulses, and to understand the reactions of others. How could this reasoning apply to people with severe mental illness?
People with severe mental illness, I'd say the most relevant element of that list would be capacity to understand, or at least understand the consequences of what they are doing. And to, I guess that's related to processing information, and sometimes to control impulses. So there's certainly overlap in that way. That's why I think, and I'm certainly not alone in believing this, that in a sense, the court has already I'm using precedent in a very loose way, but kind of set a precedent for having considered the issue of cognitive function and its relationship to guilt. They did it also, I think, in a less compelling example, but this is often invoked as well. In 2005, in the Simmons case, Simmons was a young man who was under 18. I think he was 17, and he committed a really awful murder in Missouri. He kidnapped a woman and then made her jump off a bridge after he bound her hands. So, of course, she died. And that was horrific. But his case was instrumental in establishing another Supreme Court standard where it is considered cruel and unusual violation of the Eighth Amendment to execute adolescents, basically because the argument is that their cognitive capacity is not sufficiently well-formed. I find that weak. But certainly the Atkins case, they called it mental retardation. Of course, we don't call it that now, but intellectual deficits, certainly more, to me, more relevant, more analogous. And in the courts, I think the way it often works is that there's a kind of an IQ cutoff of 70. And people, again, debate that, whether a cutoff makes more sense or whether the person's capacity, measuring the person's capacities makes more sense. But in any case, the point is people who qualify as, quote unquote, mentally retarded / cognitively disabled are immune from the death penalty. Not immune from punishment necessarily, but immune from the death penalty. You know, one might wonder, well, that's what we have NGRI for. It's for people who are so psychotic that they are effectively don't know what they're doing. You know, why should there be another accommodation for a person like Anthony, like Andrew Lee Thomas? And again, it's obvious in his case is because he didn't meet that criteria. But separately, there are questions about how the quality of his trial. But more generally, as you say, the bar for being eligible for not guilty by reason of insanity is really quite high. Generally, if it's a McNaughton standard, it's that one did not know what they were doing, or they didn't know that what they were doing was wrong. In truth, a lot of people, no matter how psychotic they are, know they're doing something wrong. The classic example of that is Andrea Yates, who was the mother in Houston. This was in 2001. And she drowned her 5 kids systematically, one after the other. They were all under, I think the oldest one was 7, because she had a postpartum psychosis, and it manifested also in religious delusions. And she thought that they were possessed by the devil, and she was saving them. But after she drowned them, she called the police, and to suggest she knew that something bad had happened. And the fact that kind of behavior is often used by the prosecution to say, well, look, they knew what they were doing was wrong. But that is at the most literal level. And we're talking about another level of appreciation. So not guilty by reason of insanity is a very tricky defense. I mean, and it should be. I could easily imagine people really trying to take advantage of such a thing. But, you know, again, when we have people who are so deeply sick, it's frankly stunning when they sometimes don't qualify. But that happens. So I think we need another middle ground for those who fail the not guilty by reason of insanity defense, but, you know, whose reasoning is still too impaired to be held fully responsible.
For the sake of our listeners, could you explain a little bit more about what the criteria are for not guilty by reason of insanity and why it's so difficult to successfully assert that as a defense?
Basically, that the perpetrator didn't know what they were doing. They thought, you know, if, for example, if someone was strangling their wife, you know, this is almost hard to imagine that people could be so confused, but that they were instead strangling, let's say, an animal or some inanimate object, that they truly did not know what they were doing. They didn't even know it was a deathly or a fatal or a dangerous act. And the second is that they did not know that it was wrong. And that's where things can get a little difficult, because even the most psychotic individual will know that. I mean, if you were to give them a test, is it wrong to murder? They would very likely say, yes, it is wrong to murder. So on that very, very narrow kind of assessment of knowledge of wrongdoing, you know, if you read it very, very narrowly, it could be hard for someone who committed a crime while psychotic to still qualify, because it's likely they knew it was wrong in the most legalistic sense. And that's why I mentioned Andrea Yates, who called the police after she strangled all her children. I mean, that was certainly could be interpreted as evidence that she knew it was against the law, but in her logical scheme, her delusional scheme, it wasn't wrong because she was saving them. It was an act of salvation. So how could that be wrong? But it is legally wrong, and she had that appreciation. And in some minds of some people, and in fact, initially in the jury's mind, because she was at first convicted, and second, and then a few years later, it was overturned. But that contributed to the jury's initial decision that she was guilty of murder.
In capital cases specifically, there's a separate sentencing phase where mitigating and aggravating factors are presented. And you've stated in your writing that oftentimes mental illness is misinterpreted by juries as an aggravating factor. In what ways could mental illness lead to a harsher sentence in capital cases?
Well, two ways. One is actually the judge as well, because they have discretion to use mental illness as a mitigating factor, but they can't not necessarily be relied on to exercise that discretion. And as far as the jury, which is what you just brought up, yeah, there are many misconceptions under which they labor, and I'm not sure how well they're educated. So, for example, people think, and, you know, I mean, I don't blame them. It sounds reasonable that if they do decide, you know, vote for not guilty by reason of insanity, that a person like, again, Andrea Lee Thomas, but you can imagine all kinds of, you know, unfortunately horrible things people have done under the sway of psychosis, that they're going to be out, that they're just going to walk out the courtroom. And that's terrifying, because jurors are frequently influenced in their decision making by predictions of violence. So that's scary. Plus, there's already a bias. I think it's a very intuitive bias that people who are mentally ill are dangerous, and just by virtue of being mentally ill. And I should say that is not a fantasy. People with psychotic illnesses who are unmedicated do have a 4 to 7 times higher rate of committing violence. So that is true. However, if they're medicated, then they are no more violent than the rest of the population. Other things that can confuse the jury is that by the time they do see the defendant, he or she has probably been medicated. You know, obviously, he or she had to be found competent to stand trial. So that often means that the medications that they've been taking are working. And so they actually can appear quite rational. And so the idea is, wait a minute, this doesn't fit. You know, this person before us kind of doesn't fit the image of this, you know, wildly psychotic individual who committed murder. So that's disorienting. Then also the medications, they have side effects. So you can also have a situation where the person is often over-medicated. And so they look very, very flat. Their eyes can be all over the courtroom, not really paying attention. They really look out of it. And to the jury, that can look like they're not taking this seriously. You know, they're so apathetic that they're not even remorseful. So that doesn't look good. Finally, I think juries don't make a distinction between something we alluded to earlier, which is factual versus rational knowledge. So in other words, it can be confusing to hear that this particular defendant knew that something was, that he did something wrong. Andrea Yates and Andrew Thomas both went to the police, and Andrew Lee Thomas turned himself in. Andrea Yates called the police, man, and he came over. So again, that looks like, well, how crazy can he be if he knew it was wrong? And that, again, is a big point of confusion, because again, while a person had this factual knowledge, it is wrong to kill, they didn't have the rational appreciation, which is, it is basically not wrong to kill people who are possessed by the devil, who are evil, this kind of thing. And so that those are reasons why it can be so hard from the, through the eyes of the jury, to meet the standard for not guilty by reason of insanity.
So how do you think we can change people's perceptions and misperceptions about mental illness in the legal system?
Well, I think we have to change people's misconceptions about severe mental illness. And I'm making a big distinction between severe mental illness and mental health, or even between anxiety and depression, which can be extremely disabling, no question. But that is still qualitatively different from, you know, psychosis, from estrangement from reality. I think in general, the public doesn't really understand, because, you know, we have so many problems now with severely mentally ill people. You know, it's complicated. They're mixed in with people whose main problems are drugs. And a lot of people with severe mental illness have drug problems as well, you know, who are crowding the streets of San Francisco, LA, Portland, outside of Philadelphia. And there are efforts to apply what I call benign paternalism, which is some form of civil commitment. And probably many people are for it, but they're for it, I think, largely through the lens of law and order, which is not something to be trivialized. That's hugely important for civic life. But I'm not sure they realize that there is a real benign, humane purpose in committing people to treatment who are gravely disabled, which is a different standard. The standard everybody understands is danger to self or other. You're going to commit suicide or kill someone else in the short term. But there's another standard, which is a little looser, some might say, which is a grave disability standard. And that's when a person is so psychotic, they think their food's poisoned. They're afraid to go into a hospital, even though they've got gangrene, or because they're so psychotic. That's another level. And I think there's so much confusion among the public that many of them are not even kind of behind that those kinds of efforts. So it goes way beyond the courtroom. But I would think, and I admit here, I don't know what kinds of education juries get, you know, before a case. But I wish someone would go through that whole list that I just went through with you about, look, this person may look a lot healthier because now they're on medication, but you'll have to keep in mind when you listen to the defense attorney what the state of the person was, and possibly there is corroborating evidence in terms of videos. I don't know, but you know, when they committed the crime, at the time of the crime, again, and also learn that there's a difference between knowing something is wrong and kind of knowing it in a way that has kind of the significance behind the crime itself, the kind of crime you commit because you have a twisted sense of what the world is like. So that's tough. Where do people get this education? In the terms of a jury, I mean, you've got a captive audience. I don't know. Are there kind of apparatus? Is there an apparatus for jurors to be educated that way? There should be.
Not really. Jury instructions don't tend to include that kind of background education. You know, it really is just here are the steps you need to follow within the law to determine the sentence. There's not education about what forensic science means that might have been presented as evidence or what mental illness can mean within the legal system. It's just kind of whatever background knowledge jurors happen to come in with.
Well, that's unfortunate. And I wish there were a way to change that. But anyway, that would be a perfect little population of people, jurors. At least you'd have, as I say, a captive audience, maybe excuse the pun. But yeah, out in the world, it's tough. I mean, that's why I write articles. That's why a treatment advocacy center, which happens to be based in Northern Virginia, which is devoted to the commitment laws in the country and the rational care of people, again, with severe mental illnesses. You know, that's why they're trying to spread the facts. When Mayor Adams, you know, launched his new initiative, which is effectively civil commitment, you know, those are opportunities to teach the public. But you don't get this in school. So it is a problem. There should be more education about it, no question. And especially in a courtroom where someone's life is in your hands.
One additional question I had for you. So in recent years, there's been an increase in state legislation specifically exempting those with severe mental illness from execution. Ohio and Kentucky have enacted those laws and legislation has been introduced in several other states. So moving forward, what legal reforms would you support in this area?
Yeah, I think the Ohio bill, I don't know its formal name, it was passed in 2021. I think it's excellent. I'll just read you what it requires of people. And it was passed with significant bipartisan support, which is very encouraging. So a person would have to meet, a defendant would have to meet two criteria. One is that by preponderance of the evidence, which really means like 51 to 49%, that they have to have a severe mental illness. There has to be enough evidence to prove a preponderance of evidence to show that they had either schizophrenia or bipolar illness or what's called delusional disorder or any other kind of psychotic manifestation. But those are the classic ones at the time of their offense. Usually psychosis brought on by drugs doesn't count, although that could be used as a mitigating factor in a trial. So we're talking severe mental illness at the time of the offense. That's one. And the second, it's not or, it's and. The second is they must show that the psychotic illness that they did have significantly impaired their capacity for rational judgment, which they define as conforming to the law or appreciating the nature, consequences, or wrongfulness of their act. And if you meet both of those, then your lawyer can apply for you to be considered ineligible for the death penalty before trial if it's already decided that you're not going to be eligible for the not guilty by reason of insanity. Or after your trial, where your lawyer has tried to apply not guilty by reason of insanity, but it failed. So you get two chances to be considered ineligible or deemed ineligible by the judge. So I think that's, you know, very fair. And then the additional benefit is that this is a retroactive law. So people who are already on Ohio's death row, if their lawyers can show those same two things, those same two points that I mentioned about the preponderance of evidence having that disease when they were committed the crime and showing that it impaired their rational judgment, then they can also be eligible to well, basically get off death row and probably be commuted to life in prison. It's not that they're going to go free. Kentucky, the year after, passed a similar law, but it's not retroactive. So it's certainly good, but it could be better. And there are other states. In fact, Texas, as we speak, a similar law that is not retroactive either, I believe. But I believe their House of Representatives has passed that. In fact, they passed it like in late March. And then now it's sitting in the Senate, and they seem to be taking a long time. But if the Senate voted, you know, then conceivably Texas could be the third state in the country to have this law. And there are other states, Arkansas, Arizona, Florida, Tennessee, which I mentioned about 5 years ago. Someone called me from a congressman's office and was working on such a bill. So I worked with her over a summer and then, you know, helped people disappear. Then I never heard from her again. But clearly it's still on the burner. Indiana, Missouri, North Carolina, Iowa, these are all states that are considering it, and or it passed one chamber, but then, you know, had to go back to be resubmitted. So they're all in various stages of considering this. And that's very hopeful. Now, ideally, the Supreme Court would rule. There would have to be some case that came before it. And I mean, that kind of would settle the issue. I mean, another option, which probably no one is going to take up, is to change the definition of what insanity is and make it more like the second prong of the Ohio law, which I can just repeat, that they have impaired capacity for rational judgment, which means either conforming to the law or appreciating the nature, consequence, and wrongfulness of their act. That part's already in the insanity defense, but this definition in Ohio has a little bit more room, but certainly not enough room to be, I think, abused. So anyway, so that's encouraging. And hopefully Andre Lee Thomas will be in August, I guess his case will be reconsidered, and two things will happen. He will either be found incompetent to stand trial, which doesn't guarantee they don't proceed with an execution, but this case has gotten quite a bit of attention, I think. You know, the governor will know he's under the spotlight or just be moved by the tragedy of the whole thing and the illegality of executing someone who doesn't know why he's being executed, and he will be commuted. That would be the best outcome for him. Of course, the best outcome would have been that he met his insanity defense originally.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
No, except that to the extent that, you know, people who are listening to your podcast, I assume, are much more enlightened about these issues than the average person, you know, just call me if you have great ideas about how to get the word out and do that, you know, yourself as well, in terms of educating, you know, at least jurors or, you know, of course, the public at large, because, you know, the better informed, the better policy.
Thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your expertise.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
For our listeners, to learn more about the death penalty, you can visit the DPIC website at deathpenaltyinfo.org. And to make sure you never miss an episode of our podcast, you can subscribe to Discussions with DPIC on your podcast app of choice.